Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Gene Sharp, who is the founder of the Albert Einstein Institution and Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. He's the author of more than a dozen books that have been translated into 45 languages and has had a direct effect on nonviolent resistance tactics around the world, from Serbia to Iran to Egypt and Russia. His works include Gandhi as a Political Strategist, Waging Nonviolent Struggle, Nonviolent Action, and his new book just out is Sharp's Dictionary of Power and Struggle, Language of Civil Resistance in Conflicts. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gene Sharp.
Thank you, Ian.
And we've spoken a few times in the past, and at this point there is a real, I think, test for nonviolent struggle going on in Syria, in as much as the original protests against this Assad family rule in Syria began as a nonviolent protest that was brutally repressed by the government. And now it seems to be slipping into a situation where there is an impending civil war because the government left no room in terms of any other form of expression or political space. So obviously, given what's happening there, what would your response be to the argument that at a certain point, when you're dealing with intractable thugs, a nonviolent struggle doesn't work?
But that's the naive response and naive thought, if we can call it that. The government does not determine what the nonviolent group can do. They can make some types of action heavily priced, so to speak. They can make severe repression. But the nonviolent struggle people can do what they decide to do. And sometimes in nonviolent struggle, there's a very heavy price to pay. That also applies, we should remember, and more so to violent struggle. Just because you shift over to violence doesn't mean your opponent's going to be loving you. But the casualty rates in violent conflict are always vastly longer, more severe than occurs in facing nonviolent struggle, although those also can be difficult.
So at the end of the day, it almost feels like you're asking human beings to be better than what they are. I mean, this is a really high bar, isn't it, to be able to face guns and tanks from a modern army that's the dictator's prepared to use against his own people?
Well, that's the nature of those regimes. If you want to get rid of them, they're not going to love you. If you say, we want to change, we want you to go. They don't then say, okay, we'll go. Bye-bye. You know, nothing like that. Those regimes are such that they often came to power through violence and often maintained their situation of violence. And when challenged, and challenged severely, as can be done by nonviolence, so more effectively than by violence, then those regimes will use the violent struggle against the nonviolent resistors, and that's a heavy price to pay, and we must admit that. But the Syrians, quite remarkably, have said repeatedly, I am not afraid, I am not afraid. And you've got to take that army committing those atrocities away from the regime, and you can't do that by a civil war, possibly. You may wage civil war and lose, and you cannot win by just doing nothing. You have to use that struggle very carefully and wisely. And the one way that can be done is getting the army in a situation it will mutiny and refuse to obey orders, as has happened in several revolutions, notably the Russian Revolution of February 1917. Massive disobedience. And this is something that people have to calculate how they're going to show, and we know that from the beginning.
Well, it does.
But one other thing. I think it was two or three nights ago on CNN I saw in Europe. There was an impression given that the army is now starting to waver. Some people have mutinied and walked out already. some of those have then tried to turn their guns on their former buddies. That doesn't work too well. But the report was that the Army is now not unreliable as yet, but verging on the unreliability, and that the regime is extremely worried about that possibility, much more so than they are the possibility of the soldiers going over and waging a civil war.
So I guess in summary, Gene Sharp, before we get to your new book, Sharp's Dictionary of Power and Struggle, Language of Civil Resistance in Conflict, just because we're touching on Syria because it's so much in the headlines, you're arguing that had the struggle remained nonviolent, it might have taken longer to get rid of the dictatorship, but there'd be less death all around. Is that a summary?
No, it's not. Sorry. And the chances are, if the struggle had remained nonviolent, the struggle would be shorter.
I see. And what's the logic? What's the logic behind that? I'm sorry to be
because you take the army away by the army refusing to carry out orders to repress and slaughter civilians in their country, and the way you do that is by maintaining nonviolent discipline. Regimes put agents into dissident groups and dissident armies, soldiers walking out in order to turn them over to violence because they have the capacity and the weaponry and enough reliable soldiers to do that. But by now, so it's a myth that it takes forever. That's a myth that I thought was gone because of the struggles that happened very quickly in Tunisia and Egypt, for example. But the now, so in this case, would be likely to be much shorter than a civil war waging for many months with massive, massive casualties and massive physical destruction.
So I guess in a way, Gene Sharp, I'm reminded of the scene in the wonderful film about Gandhi, where the workers go on strike and the police beat them, and then as they beat them down, more workers step forth in a nonviolent, passive way, and eventually the police simply can't mete out the punishment anymore. That's the argument you're making.
Well, that's a little optimistically phrased, but it's something like that.
Right.
You see, if you go over to violence, the soldiers are on the receiving end of that violence. I'm not going to send messages of love and kisses. They're going to fire you back, and that's what you must avoid. It's when they fire back that the resistance must continue, but nonviolently, because soldiers being shot shoot back. So avoid shooting at the soldiers in the first place so that you can get them in position of walking out and disobeying the regime.
So let's again remind the audience I'm speaking with Gene Sharp, who's the founder of the Albert Einstein Institution. His new book just out is Sharp's Dictionary of Power and Struggle, Language of Civil Resistance in Conflict. This is a dictionary that has an enormous body of work in terms of all the terms that one would want to know to associate with war and nonviolent struggle, and I barely know where to begin. Let me begin with one of the words in here that's come into our lexicon, into use a lot in many ways, propelled by the Occupy movement, as it's called, and that is oligarchy. Given that your work has influenced, Gene Sharp, much of the nonviolent revolutions that we've seen take place from Serbia to Iran and Egypt to Russia, how would you consider the Occupy movement in the context of these other revolutions that have taken place, in as much as what strikes me as a similarity is that the Occupy people refer to, in the same way that the young Egyptians and others say, we want our future, the word dignity comes up a lot, and we feel that a group of kleptocrats and oligarchs have stolen our future. And in many ways, that is the argument here in the United States by the Occupy movement.
That is probably accurate. But you don't define the nonviolent struggle movement by what the people want. You define the struggle by what people do. And that's a major difference. The idea that you're planning your struggle so that it's going to contribute to changing things, but simply occupying a physical space of territory or part of a city, a square, for example, and staying there does not change the economic system. It can arouse major sympathy and awareness that a lot of people are dissatisfied with the degree to which the political system is responsive to what they're interested in, and dissatisfied with the massive maldistribution of wealth in the society. Here in the United States, obviously, I heard that in England and Norway is something that's happening in Europe, you know. And this is simply expressing your opinion strongly. It's not changing. You have to develop a strategy considering what are your clear objectives and how you're going to get them, how you can really produce the changes that you want. And that's heavily influencing. You can find lots of guidance on how to do that with some tips that won't answer all your questions. But our publication, it's on our website, aeinstein.org, is Self-Liberation. It's a guide to strategic planning to remove a dictatorship or other oppression. And that requires you to do a lot of thinking and a lot of reading. And it gives you a chance to form yourselves, not outsiders, but to yourselves form a new means of struggle and a new strategy for your struggle.
So what explains, though, there's a fundamental difference between the United States and England, where you've just been, and the movements that are taking place there, demanding change and redistribution of wealth, etc. The fundamental difference between, say, Egypt and the Arab Spring and what's happening in the West is that the Egyptians and the brave young Arab men and women, they don't have democracy and they want it. But we have democracy, but we want better democracy. What is your analysis of why it is that we in the West have allowed our democracy to atrophy?
Well, that's beyond my personal capacity to judge. I'm sure there are many scholars who should be tackling that question. And I'm sure that many people are, but I don't have answers to all the problems and all the difficulties and all the second and third level of questions. But that merits attention, and you've got to give attention to that as part of your planning. What can you do to correct the situation? Well, that began a long time ago when I first had to define terms for my master's thesis in sociology at Ohio State University. Because without clear terms, you can't think clearly. And our terms have been very, in this field of nonviolent struggle and many types of conflict, the terms have been sloppy. They meant several different things, including the opposites, you know. And so I had to define terms, the nature of the types of ethical and religious nonviolence. It's not just one category, but they're about 8 or 10, you know. And somehow you get over and something as complicated as nonviolent struggle to remove serious oppression, then that works in very complicated ways. I think nonviolent struggle, contrary to some devotees, is more complicated than is violent struggle to actually, the way it works, the means you can use, and how you can get the results you want. So you have to know what you're talking about or you're thinking about. And if you do that, then you have a chance to be able to think. Without that, you can't think clearly at all. So that continued from way back. That would have been starting that in 1950, probably, or 49 or 50. And then that went on through the development of the big book, The Politics of Nonviolent Action, published in 73. And then how does this operate in certain countries under certain kinds of oppression, under totalitarian regimes, under milder dictatorships, milder oppression, and it operates in different ways. So I just kept adding terms, and I finally brought some of them together fairly quickly after 73. And those were revised again at least 3 times. So the final manuscript then was quite large. That's why there are nearly 1,000 entries and about 880-some or so defined terms. And an introductory essay on the violence and realism, nonviolent struggle and realism.
Again, I'm joined by Gene Sharp, who is the founder of the Albert Einstein Institution, and he is an author of more than a dozen books that have been translated into 45 languages and has had a direct effect on nonviolent resistance tactics around the globe, from Serbia to Iran to Egypt and Russia. His latest book is Sharp's Dictionary of Power and Struggle, Language of Civil Resistance in Conflicts. And you just mentioned Libya. I guess Libya is in many ways a test case, right, for where your notion that they should have stayed with the nonviolent resistance as opposed to a civil war with outside help. And there's still a bunch of militias running around in Libya shooting at each other. So the situation is far from clear. And you made the point that the casualties were much, much higher in Libya than they have been in Tunisia and Egypt, where there was no resort to violence. So am I correct in suggesting, Gene Sharp, that you think Libya is a test case for your thesis?
No, I wouldn't, because there was an attempt originally that I don't know a lot about to use nonviolent struggle in Libya. That was very early on, boom, 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 it's gone, that possibility. And why? Because a prominent Libyan general, very important in the Gaddafi regime, defected. And remarkably, he defected with all his soldiers and with all their weapons. And then he goes to the rebels and say, here, I'm here to help you with this. And that was a very suspicious defection. Gaddafi and one of his sons 2 weeks earlier were defecting the nonviolent struggle goal, which is civil war. He was producing civil war by the defection. And what was achieved by the regime was to kill off the nonviolent struggle component and just leave this general and his troops and their guns in place to be used supposedly against the Gaddafi regime. There was I met a Libyan authority when I was in London just a couple of weeks ago. She has a new book out. I forget the name of the book. But there was suspicion in the rebel camp that he was, in fact, a high-level agent provocateur sent into the rebel camps with his guns and troops to force in by the situation for pressure the resistance to abandon nonviolent means and go to violence. So, and he was later killed, reportedly not by the rebels who did suspect that he was a provocateur, but also by the other people because he had been killing off people from a certain Muslim group, and they were taking revenge on him. But I think that case is not relevant to the effectiveness of nonviolent struggle, because it was derailed very early on, and also by the rebels accepting those guns, thinking that would be quick, and of course, that's nonsense.
So in other words, Gaddafi manipulated the situation to make sure it was a violent struggle.
That's my interpretation.
Right. So let's turn to Russia, one of the countries you've had a lot of influence in. Last time we spoke, Gene Sharp, I think you told me that the Russians under Putin had tried to prevent your books from being translated and distributed in Russia. Am I correct in remembering that?
Well, you got it mostly right. Mm-hmm. That referring that to one of my big books, but that was From Dictatorship to Democracy. We had not given permission to anyone to translate that, but despite that, there were four independent translations. And then when we discovered that, we also discovered there was a new fifth translation. And we encouraged that we'll take that one, and that's if it's the best, and try to improve all the translation, put it together. And that new translation then went to a print shop in Moscow. And that was in the press. The presses were running. The FSB, the successor to the KGB, raided the print shop, ordered the presses to stop. The agent focused on what is this. He looked at it, and he said, that book is a bomb. Stop. And so the rebels with the manuscript took the good translation outside of Moscow to a separate printing place where it was printed. When they brought that back into Moscow and was on sale in two distant bookshops in Moscow. And mysteriously, those two bookshops caught fire. You know, not everybody throughout the world, whether it's in Burma or anyplace else, really loves people struggling for their freedom nonviolently, and they will regard this correctly as the most severe threat to their control that could be made.
Well, one of the things, though, Gene Sharp, that I find encouraging about Russia is that there's always been an assumption that somehow the Russians genetically prefer an autocracy. They prefer a strong man, a czar, that somehow this kind of peasant mentality has been inculcated over the centuries. And it seems to be completely false, that the Russians have shown lately that they're very unhappy with the kind of modern capitalist, communist, hybrid dictatorship that Putin has managed to usurp, I guess.
I agree with you that they are not genetically inclined to violence. You just have to look a little bit at Russian history. The 1905 revolution went on for a year, overwhelmingly nonviolent and very, very courageous. Where it's shootings of people in Palace Square and near the palace. In days when you had just simple guns instead of machine guns, and something that almost 400 people killed on one day in that case. Then it was still remained nonviolent. And the great October strike that Gandhi learned from in South Africa, and he wrote, "We must learn to use this Russian method against tyranny." And then on in Russian revolutionary history, because that first revolution was derailed because Lenin and his cohorts wanted to shift the struggle to violence, and then they engineered the October strike in Moscow, not the October, but another general strike in Moscow, which would go over to violence, because then the same principle is in Libya. If you're shooting at their opponents of the regime who have defected from the army, and they're shooting at the remaining soldiers in the army, those soldiers of the regime will shoot back. And when they shoot back, they are supporting the regime, and that enables it to carry on.
And of course, a bloody civil war followed almost a decade?
Well, not quite. Yeah. You had quiescence in terms of massive struggle after the end of 1905. Some struggle went on in 1906. Then it wasn't until February 1917, not October, but February, a massive revolution of all social classes, including the nobility and the proletariat, used nonviolence struggle and brought down the Tsar system there. Violence in the Tsar had nothing to do with it.
Right, but there was a civil war that followed.
There was a civil war after the Bolsheviks.
Exactly.
The coup d'etat in October, and then there's a civil war. That was not because of the February nonviolent revolution.
Sure. Well, it's wonderful to talk to you, Gene, and I'm so grateful, and our audience are so grateful for the work that you've done and the enormous effect it's had on this planet. I mean, what did you think of Time Magazine's Person of the Year, The Protester?
To be honest, I didn't see it.
Well, you're learning about it now.
Okay.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us and for your new book, Sharp's Dictionary of Power and Struggle, Language of Civil Resistance in Conflict.
Well, thank you, Matt. You're always welcome.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Gene Sharp, who's the founder of the Albert Einstein Institution and Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. He's the author of more than a dozen books that have been translated into 45 languages. He's had a direct effect on nonviolent resistance tactics around the globe, from Serbia to Iran to Egypt and Russia. His works include Gandhi as a Political Strategist, Waging Nonviolent Struggle, Nonviolent Action, and his new book, just out, is Sharp's Dictionary of Power and Struggle, Language of Civil Resistance in Conflicts. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.